Welcome to the School Sucks Project,
a podcast, YouTube channel, and an online community
dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives,
home education,
critical thinking,
peaceful parenting,
organization and productivity,
and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get
infographics,
comprehensive show notes,
relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow.
Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast.
And get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
So that which one problem is, it's like coming out of the schooled model, parents are going to balk at this whole realm of possibilities, right? This whole spectrum of possibilities. I mean, well, which one would be absolutely perfect for my child? So to take this experience that you had, Sudbury, North Star, all of the theory that you had been involved with, other people that you're collaborating with at Epic, I think that really like works to your benefit as far as being able to outreach to people and maybe reassure people. It's not one way or you fail kind of proposition here.
Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately an eclectic mix of what aligned with me, the community that I knew I was going to be serving, and the other people that were going to be creating the community with me is really what led me to want to really be like a liberated learners model with agile tools. I don't think that I was sure at all what model I liked personally, but I went from what model do I like or do I feel like I want to be a part of to also like, every community is different. If I was going to create a learning community in New York City, it might look very different than to create one in Dallas or to create one in like rural California or somewhere. You know, like these are very different types of people, families, communities. So I think it's also important to, when you're creating a learning community, really considering who you're going to be serving. And then if who you're serving needs something different, being willing to change. That's what I love about Agile. It's the whole idea of we're going to change and it's okay. And it doesn't have to be static and it doesn't have to be just, these are the rules and these are the things and this is how Epic works. It can change. And we've changed how things at Epic worked constantly since we've started. It's building the plane in the sky. So to pretend like we're not building this plane in the sky and that we've got this finished model perfectly polished is an illusion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
We're all new here.
Sitting on the back porch, sipping lemonade. I got some satisfaction, I really got it made. The radio is humming, all my favorite tunes.
Hi, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is Sunday, January 31st. My guest joining us for the first time is Cassidy Younghands. She is one of the founders at Epic Life Learning. We're going to be talking about that today and in a future show. I first heard Cassidy's story last year. She is a former public school teacher. I thought it was wonderful. I really identified with it. I said, that is a story that someday I want to be told on this show, and today is that day. I'm really excited to have another opportunity to amplify a story about a person who's doing really exciting things in alternative education and self-directed learning. And I think there's a lot of great takeaways for parents or friends of parents or family members of parents who are, if you know somebody who's kind of like on the edge of, might be time to look for a better way, a new way of doing this. Today's show, I think, provides lots of helpful information. Cassidy is a great advocate for various forms of self-directed learning, as you heard discussed very briefly in that intro. So please check the show notes for links to her personal site, for links to Epic Life Learning, and I hope you'll take a closer look at everything that she is doing. One thing that I really quickly want to mention, I've only told people in our Facebook group about this so far. 4 months I have been encouraged to create a presence on Locals. It's the platform that people like Michael Malice are always promoting. I have done this. It is schoolsucksproject.locals.com. Now, I mean, we've been on Patreon for 4 years, though. We're still on Patreon. And if you're on Patreon, just kind of hang out there. Let's try to spread everybody out during this purge here. That would be my preference. But yeah, I've been on Patreon for 4 years. So obviously, it's going to be hard to move all of the members-only content to a new platform in an expedient way. But you'll never guess what I've done. You'll never guess what I have managed to accomplish in just a couple of days. For all the serial bonus shows that we do, which includes the Picture of the Month Club, our film appreciation show, In Pursuit of Utopia, our history show that I do with Danny McCarthy and Kevin Cole, and The Discomfort Zone, a personal development show that I do with my good friend Andrew, all of that has been organized into sequential SoundCloud playlists. And all of that is waiting for you as soon as you become a supporting member of our Locals community. Because we're looking to have community here. Facebook has been our hub for about 6 years, but that's about to end. So if you want new ways to stay in touch, this is another alternative besides this private community that I've been talking about. But by now, you know the details of that was all discussed in our show, MySpace, episode 697. And maybe I'll see you there, and maybe I won't. You know, I probably won't. Honestly, most of you, I probably won't see you there. I think I'm capping it at 200 people. Is there spots left? Sure. But the ball is in your court, you know? In the meantime, please check out Cassidy's work. I think you're going to be very, very impressed with this discussion. And she will be back at some point in the future to discuss agile learning tools and how they are used at Epic Life Learning. So thank you so much for listening. I hope to be able to see some of you somewhere else someday and have a two-way conversation. One of the reasons why I sound so hyper right now is just minutes ago, finished an almost two-hour-long Sunday morning conversation with our university weekly discussion group. Probably the best conversation, one of the biggest and best conversations we ever had. New people are coming into that group, so we did some introductions, and a brand new person brought a great topic, and it opened up an hour of really meaningful and connected conversation. So I'm riding high from that, but the good times are about to continue. Here's my conversation with Cassidy Younghands. Thank you for listening. Here we go. It's all right if you wanna. Yeah, yeah. It's all right if you're gonna. Yeah, yeah. It's all right if you need to. Yeah, yeah. It's all right, you can be you. Yeah, yeah. It's all right if you wanna. Yeah, yeah. It's all right if you're gonna. Yeah, yeah. It's all right if you need to. Yeah, yeah. It's all right, you can be you. Yeah, yeah. It's all right. Yeah, yeah. It's all right if you need to. Yeah, yeah. It's all right if you're gonna.
Cassie, welcome to School Sucks.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. I think I first heard about you last year. You were on Blake Bowles' podcast. He's a friend of the show. He's been on in the past.
Yeah, well, I was super grateful to know Blake because he was one of the first people that inspired me to do this kind of work. So I'm really glad that you know him too.
Yeah, I've been meaning to reconnect with him. I know he has like a new book, or a fairly new book, right?
Yes, yes. Why to Not Send Your Kids to School? Why to Take Your Kids Out of School? Something very similar to that.
Have you read it?
I've read half of it. It's definitely one of those books that if you're a family and you just don't know what to do with your kid, and you're not sure if you want to take the leap to do something, you know, more alternative. They're really good. Quells all the fears, mm-hmm. I think, you know, with some good evidence and reasoning. Because Blake's very logical, I feel like, and reasonable about, you know, explaining the movement.
Absolutely. And in the last year of all of our lives, more of those people with those questions have been created. I wonder if you're running into more of them down there in Texas.
Definitely. I mean, definitely a lot more people questioning. But it's interesting because there's people that are still only questioning so much to their own personal convenience, right? So there's people that are maybe looking for something different, but really just still for childcare. They're not looking for something different because their value system has changed. The value is still here. I need to drop my kid off somewhere.
Yeah.
And so that's been a little bit rough because I think, you know, we get all this interest, but then it's like, there's not alignment. There's not buy-in to what we actually believe. There's just, kid, I have a kid. Where do I put them? Or things like that. So it's not been quite as, like, I guess, revolutionary as I would have hoped. But I do think it's planting seeds for down the line. I think a lot of parents that have kids in public school have seen a little bit more into how it actually looks and how their learning actually feels and how it's hard to get their kids to get on virtual because their kids really don't want to go to school or whatever it is, right? So they're seeing at least some of that, which I think had been kind of hidden in the school buildings. Parents were just like, okay, I drop my kid off. They must learn from 9 to 4. They just learn that whole time and it's just such a rich experience. And then now they're virtual and their kid's right there in the living room with them. And they're like, whoa, this is it. This is what's happening. I think that's definitely a good starting place. And then with COVID bringing everybody kind of back into family, I think is a really great thing because I think homeschooling really starts with taking ownership back as a family of the educational journey of you and your children.
Yeah, absolutely.
Taking a little bit of that ownership back as far as just having to deal with how do you, you know, live as a small family with COVID, during COVID, I think hopefully will also bring in some more deeper connection within the family unit so that they can meet each other's needs more. Because I do feel like it's like the adults are at work and the kids are at school and nobody's talking about needs, and then they all come home and they're all tired and they all have more to do.
So
there's no space. Whereas this last year, there's been, I believe, a lot of space for that.
Yeah, it's been easier to ignore problems and unmet needs the way things have been. And now there's this situation for people who are trying to do this outreach to maybe, you know, give people what they want, but ultimately provide what they need, but they don't kind of know what those needs are. I mean, I've been doing my show for almost 12 years. And one of the things that I've realized is suddenly there is all of these people have all of these questions and all of these problems, but they don't speak the same language that we speak, right? They've never said the words self-directed education or self-directed learning. They unschooling sounds terrible to them, right? Like that's must be the opposite of education. Unschooling, right. The synonymous relationship between schooling and education, of course, is another huge barrier to get around with a lot of these people who now are really identifying problems. They're becoming more problem aware, whatever level it is, from elementary up through higher ed. Parents are seeing problems. They've, I guess, been able to, in many cases, just be like willfully ignorant of in the past. This is somebody else's responsibility. It's being taken care of. I'm certainly paying for this in one form or another. So, yeah, I mean, I have said since last March, this is certainly an age of opportunity. Who would you commend, if anybody, doing a good job with outreach right now in trying to tap into it's definitely a market for sure, but like trying to connect with people who've identified these problems and are now looking for solutions, even if they don't really know what to look for yet.
As far as families or as far as like Galileo and some cool, like different things that are popping up for families.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about Galileo? Cause that's been on my radar for a while and I haven't done the in-depth investigation yet.
Yeah. I mean, I only know so much as well, but they're, you know, international self-directed space virtually for ages 4 to 18, from what I understand, maybe even younger. I'm not 100% clear. They have tons of amazing online courses that kids, again, they choose all of what they take. They have a mentor. They have kind of like, I think, a group that they kind of meet with consistently, like a small group of other kids. And it's kind of, I feel, the closest to self-directed, but virtual. Because if self-directed is so hard to me, if it's not in person, like to me, a huge part of it is the environment and learning from each other. And that really is easier to me and more natural in person, of course. But I think Galileo is doing a great job of trying to meet that need and for people who, you know, don't feel comfortable being in person, or people who don't have the opportunity to be in person, or don't have a self-directed space near them, you know, or any other various thing, or any families that are like, okay, this public school virtual isn't working. Is there other virtual stuff that my kid could do where they could still have support? They could pursue things they're interested in. They would want to go to the classes. And so I could see people maybe, you know, if they're wanting to shift, move towards something like Galileo, I think would be really, that's a really good resource. I think one of my favorite people in self-directed that was a founder of Epic works for Galileo now. Her name's Kristen Montesano. So Kelsey Brock, Jordan Brock, and I were all the founders of Epic originally. And Kristen was at Epic our first year. And so now she works at Galileo. She does, you know, 3D printing and design classes. She does coding with Scratch, with Unity, I think, Blender. She does a lot of really awesome things with the young people through Galileo now. So it's really cool to see like her now, you know, move from being with us at Epic in person to doing this really rich, amazing thing that's serving, you know, internationally for young people.
So you mentioned Epic, and that's going to be a big feature of our conversation today. I'm excited to talk about that. I was going to ask, based on what you just said, how that environment has been affected in the last year, but I just previewed that and we'll get to that. I want to talk mostly about your self-directed education advocacy and your journey, which in many ways was actually similar to mine. When I first heard your story, I was like, oh, wow, here's another person with a story like this. I want you to start at the beginning, since this is the first time you've been on the show, and let the audience get to know you. You were a public school teacher for 5 years. We could start at, like, why did you want to do that? You know, what were the personal and professional needs that you were trying to satisfy with that? And as is often the case with guests who have this experience, we'll get to your I could no longer story. Like, I could no longer do this, experience this, deal with this, what that looked like. So frustrations that you had, what you tried to do before you moved on, and what ultimately led to you moving on. So please start at the beginning.
Okay, so I was born. No, I'm just kidding.
But wait a minute. That was actually a good point. Did you go to public school after, like 6 years after you were born?
This is a great question. So yeah, that's actually a really good place for me to start. So I started in Montessori school. Mm-hmm. And even before Montessori school, my mom and my dad were both getting master's degrees at UNT. And they actually had I think they were called like a lab school or something where the little kids can go. But they're still doing they allow for like their psychology students and their child development students to like observe children, but it's also like a really rich daycare environment within the campus. So usually they're actually pretty forward thinking in those lab schools, but I don't think those are existing as much as they used to. Right. But they did. And some of them are closing because of COVID. So I was in one of those when I was really young. So even from a really young age, you know, my mom was talking to people in the child development world. My dad and my mom met in a child development class when they met in college. So to me, like these are all kind of things that to me connect. When I was four, my mom was like, you know, okay, she's aged out of this program. I'm really interested in putting her into Montessori. My mom did a bunch of research and felt like Montessori was a really great model and that it would really help me thrive. And so for me, Montessori was an amazing experience, like amazing. You know, there was like 10 kids in my class and we were first through fourth grade all together, like just everybody accepts everybody, even though everybody's weird. And you know what I mean? And there's no like, oh, you're wearing that. There's like, there's no hierarchy of, you know, in my perspective at that age of like class or like race or anything like that, wasn't talked about, or at least again, like highlighted. Because it was such a small group. It was like more like a family. And the teachers weren't like, shake my finger at you, yell at you. It was mm-hmm. more like cooperative. And you could go to the bathroom whenever you wanted to. And you could eat a little bit more like when you needed to, but usually also mostly still at lunch. And right. recess was longer. And you could choose kind of when did you want to do each activity. But you still had activities chosen for you to do. So there was a little bit of more self-paced, a little bit more trust, a little bit more autonomy than obviously is in, you know, a public school environment. So I was there from like 4 until 10.
In retrospect, you know, I went through public school. I didn't get to have the Montessori experience, but like looking back at with the, you know, the wisdom of an adult at that time, like all my friends who went to Montessori, they seemed to be a step ahead when we get to like the public school experience. And I think a lot of it is like having that, like, oh, I'm a person.
Yes.
I'm very small, but somebody has already kind of treated me like a person. And they're introduced to these ideas, things they don't even have the vocabulary to understand yet, like autonomy, such an important concept. But if you just go to like nursery and kindergarten, I don't remember having any awareness. I just felt like I was totally at the whim of other people, whether it was my peers or adults. And obviously the public school experience was reinforcement for that. Most of life, unfortunately, I think for too many people is a reinforcement of that. But looking back, the kids who had come from Montessori, because I learned about it when I was 6, because my friend said I went to Montessori mm-hmm. and it was a memorable word.
Yeah.
At the end, to like reflect, it's like, oh, those kids were ahead in elementary school in a lot of ways, not just academically, but like behaviorally and just even in like sense of self.
I think I was in a lot of ways in that place but then my parents said, okay, but now Montessori is not available for middle school and high school. And most places that's really true. There mm-hmm. are programs that are being built up to do that or like trying to create a project-based version of that. Or sometimes Acton academies are kind of saying they can kind of try to step in when Montessori ends for people. They're similar models maybe as what Acton is kind of saying, at least that I've read. But for me, it was a stark transition, right? It was like, okay, this age, super, you know, open-minded people, small group, very family-minded and really thinking about judgment or how people are different, but really how are the same. And again, like being treated like a human by adults, being treated like, okay, I can do my bodily functions without needing to beg someone. And then straight into a public school environment, which was a really judgmental, non-accepting, coercive, and even with adults, just a really unsafe feeling environment yeah. for me. It was so different. Mm-hmm. And even just, I remember a math teacher that I really specifically in sixth grade, my first year in public school, had a huge like drag out just issue with throughout that year because she wouldn't let me go to the bathroom. And I'm like, this is when I have to go. Like lunch is this period. This mm-hmm. is how bodies work, right? Lunch is this period. Your period is 2 after that period every single day. And that's when my body has processed this food and is ready to do something with it. I'm sorry that it's your class every time. It's not personal.
And you couldn't be like, wait a minute, let me go get my science teacher.
No. And the thing is I didn't speak up for myself, right?
Yeah,
so
no,
it wasn't
sure.
Like I was like, hey, that's not a right thing to do. I've been treated differently. It was more like, wait, is this what I deserve to be treated like this? And I don't understand. And I'm confused. Did I do something wrong? Like, did I ask to go in the wrong way? And then she would say no in front of the whole class and it would be so embarrassing. And then I would sit there really uncomfortable. I ended up getting a UTI. I'm not even exaggerating. Like in sixth grade, going to public school, I got a UTI because I was too scared to go to the bathroom, to get asked to ask and be told no after I was told no.
Oh, it's such an important point. The implicit message for too many people in that system is like, if this isn't going well, something is wrong with me.
Yes.
You ever heard of John Cazale?
Yeah, Jonathan Cazale.
Yeah, one of the great Johns of school criticism and reform and really self-directed learning too. So Cazale wrote this book called The Night is Dark and I'm Far from Home, like in the 70s or 80s. And he was one of my first encounters with institutional school criticism. And in like chapter 3 or 4 of the book, he says something like, we go into public schools and we're welcomed like, hey, child, everything has already been figured out and, you know, the conveyor belt is running. You're free to jump on as long as you behave, right? As long as you act right, you're free to participate in this thing that is already, it's like kind of like how textbooks are written, right? There's no questions in the history textbook, just like there's no questions in the math textbook. There's no questions really in the science. It's like everything is settled. So in this settled society, in this settled system that works perfectly, all you can do is disrupt it by not behaving.
Mm-hmm.
You're welcome to participate if you act right. I don't think I ever heard anything like a teacher say, and I don't even think a lot of teachers are aware of a lot of this. And I totally understand that a lot of them are there with the best of intentions for sure. And it does become difficult to integrate criticisms of the system when it's a profession that people really have their identities tied up in a lot of ways. So I'm totally sympathetic to that. And you probably experienced that as a public school teacher to a certain extent, especially when,
You know,
like when I was a young teacher, I was very proud of doing that. And I probably wouldn't have accepted criticism. I mean, I was working in private school and the stuff that was going on in this school was insane. It was literally criminal, right? It was a boarding school in western part of New England in Vermont. But I would have had a very difficult time confronting some of the things that were going on there that were like suboptimal, especially as far as like serving children or even like serving myself as a professional and my own sort of professional self-esteem. So I understand like all of the obstacles that are, when it comes to trying to outreach to teachers and parents and even like former students. Like I think a lot of former students, they don't want to acknowledge a lot of the unhealthy aspects of a system like
yes.
this that were put upon them.
Yes.
Lots of difficulty.
Oh my gosh. No, I know. That's actually something that's very true. My dad is a very forward thinker, but it took me having to ask over and over again. So how was your educational experience? How was your educational? And just asking like again and again, like, more and more, what would you have needed differently? And then now he's like super into self-directed, but it took him really unpacking and being vulnerable to say like, hey, like, no, that didn't really serve me. Wow. I gave so much of my time and so many years to this public school system. And it kind of robbed me in some ways. And it may have helped me in some ways, but it really hurt me in these other ways. And I didn't have a choice, or I felt like I didn't have a choice. And so that's really hard to look back on. I think that's true with a lot of things, like not to go into a rabbit hole, but like, I think that's true with circumcision as just a separate example. You know, bringing that up to men is really hard because a lot of them have been without their own choice circumcised. So to talk to them about their children, maybe not doing that is really challenging, I think, because then you have to reckon with, oh, what was done to me maybe wasn't something I was okay with or something I consented to. So it's, to me, it's somewhat similar. But going back to what you were saying about the, like, you know, as a child feeling like I was the wrong one, right? So I was wrong and the system that I was just now being put in was right. And I was broken and I was supposed to just, you know, figure out how to, you know, fit into that system. It's crazy how, for me, I went from that sixth grade year of having that crazy experience and it being really hard and kind of traumatic for me to try to figure out how to change myself and adjust myself to feel safe in that environment, or at least to pretend I did. I continued to do that and then became a teacher and continued to do that. So what happened when I became a teacher was the exact same thing. It was, I did not fit in. I was not like any of them. I was wrong. The way I wanted to relate to kids was wrong. The way I wanted to teach things was wrong. I took kids outside when it snowed in Texas, and that was wrong. Like, you know what I mean? Like, so I hung out with the kids after school that didn't have anywhere to go. That was wrong. All of these different things. And so even so, it's crazy because I felt I got put in a system that was, sixth grade was terrible for me, and then sustained this, like, whatever behavior I had to have to make it through. And then college was a little better because, you know, you get to kind of pick when your classes are, and you have a little bit more autonomy as a person because you've moved out of home. But then still putting myself right back into that system, just as the person with the power. Mm-hmm. But then not with the power, because then the people that I was working with and for were like, you're crazy. It was a really terrible experience, I think, the whole way through. And I didn't even realize how invalidated I felt, how just wrong as a person. I'm just wrong and I'm broken and I'm wrong. Really, really terrible feeling that I'm sure a lot of people that went through education and then became teachers might actually experience, but not really realize it if they don't reflect.
So I had this really weird experience that I just want to share with you quickly and actually get your thoughts on. So I'm probably going through all this maybe like a decade before you were. And when I was like 23 or 24 years old, I became the lead teacher of this specialized program on, it was like this whole separate campus of a boarding school. And it was what they called at the time sexually reactive behavior issues. And it was a very difficult place to work. Nobody wanted the job. So with no educational credentials, I went to the administrators of this school and I said, make me in charge of that whole place. I was 24. And they're like, okay, your funeral. So I went there and I did it for 2 years and then asked them to move me to a more desirable job. I put in my time and they did. When I first got there, I spent an entire year saying, what is a good teacher according to everybody but me and the students, right?
Yes. So that's the question that you feel like you have to answer. Yep.
Yeah. So this is a very schooled mindset.
Insanely. Like, you're just like, how do I keep fitting in? It's the same question. How do I change myself? Mm-hmm. How do I reinvent myself to be the cog in whatever system I'm supposed to fit into?
Right. So I go through a whole school year like this of just trying to force school on these kids who have all kinds of like emotional, behavioral, learning disabilities, like all kinds of challenges like that. It's a diverse group, not just like racially. It was a boarding school that was pulling rural kids from Vermont with inner city kids. And those were tensions that they really liked to exploit, even though they had all the same problems and refused to realize it, right? Like, they were dealing with a lot of the same struggles. And it just was like, it was easier to antagonize about outward appearances. But they also, it was an age range of like 6 or 7 years, which is usually a good thing and actually worked out pretty well, as like older kids wanting to mentor younger kids appreciating that, older kids getting some agency from doing that and feeling like, you know, they're actually doing something meaningful instead of just being schooled at. So there were advantages to that, but there were challenges as well. So I fought through a whole year of doing that. And then at the end of it, and just looking at how restrictive this program was behaviorally, because these kids had to live separately from everybody else, they were schooled separately, they were very restricted lifestyles because of their high risk for sexually inappropriate behavior. That was kind of what they were told. And I apologize to my audience for telling this story for the 150th time right now, but one of the most jarring things about this experience was whenever a staff would turn their back on a group of like 3 or 4 kids or walk out of a room for a second, leaving them just momentarily unsupervised, they would start chanting, unsafe, 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 until they made eye contact with that staff member again. So this was, that was the face that I made when I saw it too. So I went to the psychologist who ran the program, and this was like 2003, 2004. And I go, what are we going to do with these young people when they leave here? Are they going like straight into a mental institution, or are we trying to mainstream them back into society? Because if it's the latter, they're all going to fail. They're all going to fail because not only do they have staff members from residential to educational to clinical reinforcing a terrible lack of self-trust. This high level of super couldn't watch shows like SpongeBob SquarePants because things about it were deemed inappropriate by certain members of the residential or clinical staff. So I said, if we're actually trying to set these kids up for some level of success, the entire program here needs to change. And this psychologist, who, you know, he was maybe, I don't know, 15 years older than me, he'd been there for a while, he was certainly a wise guy, so very empathetic. He goes, I've been waiting for someone to say that. He said, so me and you will take this to, if you can come up with a plan educationally and you can get buy-in from the residential staff, we can take this to the administration. And the truth is, they'll probably let us do whatever we want because out of sight, out of mind, right? These kids were kept miles away from the rest of the campus. So we actually developed a life skills curriculum. I broke basically every rule of what I thought was a good and this is about how do I make these kids happy and how do I make myself survive another year? Like, how do I not thrive, but after year one, how do I survive year two? So I broke every rule that had kind of been implicitly imposed on this environment, including like restrictions. We started watching like PG-13 and rated R movies, and I would talk to them about that. If the clinical staff needed to come in and talk to them, and we was just like acclimating them to more of like the challenges and the realities of the world. And they learned about, you know, writing checks, having jobs, buying food. We started a newspaper, and that got a lot of like accolades from the whole campus. So they were doing things that were meaningful. Now I left the next year to take a better job, and everything reverted right back to the way it had been before I got there. And that was really sad, but it was easier. It was easier from a management and warehousing perspective to do that. Well, I moved on.
Right.
And for some reason, 25, 26 years old, I immediately revert back to what makes me a good teacher in this new environment. How do I please my superiors in this new environment? And it took like until I started this show like 12 years ago to fully unlearn that kind of schooled mindset. So I bring all that up because I'd like to hear about your journey of feeling that as a public school teacher, which is like sacrificing your own needs or not properly, I don't know, acknowledging or trying to serve the needs of students, which is really a problem in that environment, and how you learned your way out of that situation.
Yeah, I always wanted to be a teacher. I had my Barbies all lined up and was like, we're going to learn today. Listen, this is, you know, what's going to happen. I made worksheets for my dad and told him to get questions wrong so that I could grade it and write an X and all of that kind of stuff. My dad bought me like a teacher desk when I was like 9 and got like me like one of those fake Apples that like looks like the like teacher. I had like a little fake typewriter and it was like, it was all, you know, super intense. So I've definitely, you know, been drawn to working with young people for a long time, but really in that idealistic way, right? So leaving college, I was like, okay, I'm going to change the world. You know, I'm going to be that teacher that I needed, that teacher that so many kids needed when, you know, that quote, like, I want to be who I needed when I was younger. So that's really what drew me to wanting to be a teacher. And then of course, like very, very quickly being, you know, confronted with very harsh realities. It was hard because I found it like a probably the best public school job for myself that I could find. It felt, the words I'm coming up with, like serendipitous maybe, or like just the way that things fell together. Mm-hmm. It really just presented, this job just presented itself to me. So I went to a job fair and I was actually super sick. So I only got to talk to like 3 different schools when I was there. I just had like a stomach ache. And this was like 7 years ago at this point. I talked to 3 schools, and one of the 3 schools I talked to was a school that was just opening in Grand Prairie called Grand Prairie Fine Arts Academy. So it was a fine arts academy, but it was a public school, but it had in-district kids and it was going to accept kids out of district. And there was going to be like an audition process. It was going to be a middle school and a high school. So first year of this school, a first year principal and first year me. And she was specifically seeking people that had experience in the arts. So not necessarily like, you know, that I was going to be an art teacher because I went to school to be an English teacher, but that the English teacher, the math teacher, the science teacher, like that we all had some passion in the arts. And so, you know, I play guitar, ukulele, I write poetry, I'm really into photography and things like that. So that was really in alignment. And so I got hired super fast, like 2 weeks after that, you know, and I got her all my information. She called me and she's like, you're hired. Let's go. Let's do this. And so I taught 7th grade English at a brand new school where there was a lot of like, how can we do this differently? Conversation, right? Like, how can we think outside of the box? How can, instead of a square school, how can we be like more like a circle, or like just that whole like thinking differently as an energetic way to start the place. But then when it came to actually implementing some of those ideas or pushing the envelope further, it just wasn't going to happen. So we kept being told as all of the staff, hey, you know, we're going to think outside of the box. We're going to do things differently. And at the end of the day, it was still extremely test score focused. So even though we were like, we're not going to worry about the test, it's like, that's all we ended up worrying about. We're a first year school having to prove to the district that we're a good school, right? That we work, that the principal's doing her job. So it doesn't really matter if the kids are happy. It matters the first year if the scores are good, right? Because how are we going to stay open? How is the principal going to keep her job? So then it changed from, oh, let's be creative and think outside of the box. Once the kids were there, it was like, nope, buckle down. You got to get these scores. Mm-hmm. You know, let's make a bunch of charts and do a bunch of incentive programs for kids so that they get the right grades. and at the same time in staff meetings was showing us videos like Ken Robinson's How Schools Kill Creativity. I'm sitting in there and I'm like, this is what we're doing. What are you showing me this for? This is torture. Like, I actually was kind of like tearing up.
Yeah.
I was like, what? And then she showed the next year, year two, she showed Logan LaPlante's Hack Schooling Makes Me Happy. And she's like, how can we help our kids hack their education? So then I go, oh, this is such a great video of this 13-year-old empowered kid. Let me show my kids in class and see how they want to hack their education. I show this to them thinking I'm such this amazing adult that's going to show them, look, you can really take control of your life. And then they're like, yeah. And then I'm like, so after I show them the video, I'm like, so how are you going to hack your education? And they're like, young hands, we don't have any of this freedom, right? Like, we can't do any of the things that he does. So why you're mean? Like, basically, like, why are you showing this to us? Like, this is completely irrelevant to our experience. And so then that was probably one of the first times that was like smack in the face. I thought I was bringing something that was very hopeful and idealistic to the kids. And they're like, yeah, that's idealistic as shit. Doesn't work. I can't do that. That's never going to be a choice for me.
Right.
And of course, I'm bringing it to kids in a low socioeconomic environment as well. So it's like, I'm like, hey, throw away everything and just like go to learn how to ski. And they're like, oh.
Same. My goodness. So I'm in graduate school and these professors who are so disconnected from reality, they're saying the exact same thing. They're saying, think outside the box. Right. Now, all of the people that I'm in graduate school with are already public school teachers in the states of New York and Massachusetts. Right. Which have really have just taken like all the standard stuff. I mean, they're really hard states to do a lot of things. There's a lot of bureaucracy around education and everything else in these states. So we're in Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts, and this professor is pontificating about the importance of thinking outside the box. A public school teacher in New York raises his hand. I remember he was so memorable. He was very tall and lanky and he had a laptop and he was the only one in the class with a laptop. And he'd sit there and he'd type. Okay, here's a little typings. But he said something like, he was nice about it, but it was effectively like, do you know where we work? Like, I have people, this is where I learned about a lot of like the No Child Left Behind bean counting that was going on. So he says, I have a person who comes into my classroom with a clipboard, doesn't knock, doesn't introduce himself, doesn't say why he's there, opens the door while I'm teaching, while I'm required to write, you know, state standard 1.2762 on the board because kids love to know what state standard number they're dealing with.
Yeah.
Comes in with a clipboard, looks around, checks a few things off, walks out without saying anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Make sure you have the state standard on the board. Make sure the classroom meets all these certain specifications. This is our box. How do we get out of it? I'd love to not be in that box. So yeah, there, I mean, I realized that too. Like, there was a lot of fanciful thinking about like the constructivist model, you know, versus the instructivist model of education. But people who teach in teacher training programs or in educational leadership grad programs, at least as it was when I was going through it, and this was a while ago now, they wanted to talk like Sudbury people, right? They're like, I know what education should be. So while I live here in Ivory Tower fantasy land, I'm going to act like that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
But it was not preparing us for the realities. Like, when I went to student teach, I was like, this sucks. This is awful. I hate this. I look at how bored these kids are. And even when I moved on to like private education services and I tried to go in and be like, guess what? I know you've dealt with all these other adults, but I'm cool. You know, and these kids would be like, no, you're not. I know exactly what you are. You're another person here to impose things on me and steal my time. So you're not cool.
Yeah. And you're not going to win their trust. I mean, you're not going to win their trust anytime quickly. Right. Mm-hmm. If you do demonstrate it, it would be over the course of months, if not longer. And even still, like, I know a guy named David Lane who tried to have a self-directed class within a public school environment. So he pitched the idea to the board of the public school, like, I'm going to have a class that's just about self-directed education. Just what do you want to do for this time? Let me help you. Let me support you. Hold space for that. And, you know, the kids were all just like using it as a study hall because they have homework due in the other classes. And this wasn't real. Self-directed learning wasn't something that they were even, you know, actually had access to. And then, you know, again, he was saying like, you have this, you have choices. We can do this, this, this. And they're like, no, we can't. So even that, he was like, that just didn't work. I wanted it to work where I could like infiltrate from within, and it just didn't work that way.
Yeah, it's this, you're trying to go the wrong way in the stream. And I really felt like
against the grain.
Absolutely. Exactly. And I really, when I taught like the upper levels of high school, your
ability for intervention. I don't want to be deterministic or self-defeating, but what I felt like at, I don't know, what was I, 26, with the resources that I had, you know, like emotionally, intellectually, wisdom, like I think I wanted to do good. And I started like trying to sneak stuff in because I also felt like, I think once I became comfortable with like, okay, I'm good, I'm doing lesson plans, I'm pleasing the people above me, once all that stuff was taken care of, I wanted to feel like I was doing a good job. And if kids are falling asleep in my class, I don't feel that way. So I started, this was like when YouTube was fairly new. So I started provoking them. Like I would bring in moon landing hoax videos. I wasn't trying to promote the moon landing hoax. I will be clear. But I was like, what do you guys think of this? Because all this stuff was just like a fire hose coming at us on like Google Video and YouTube at the time. And I was like, I'm going to provoke these kids into, you know, I started going like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky and people like that. And just, and this school was run by like super conservative people too. We started reading People's History of the United States just because I was like, I'm going to shock you into making eye contact with me, students, while I'm talking. I will do it. I will achieve this, but for my own sense of like self-worth and self-efficacy. So that like the second year I was there, that became part of my project. While the first year was just like, it was the same pattern as before. Year one, please everybody above me. Year two, let's try to like actually find some satisfaction and some growth in this for myself and hopefully for the students. But that was a selfish thing to like try to engage students to make me feel better about myself. And some of it worked. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I made great relationships with a few kids through doing that. But it really was just like, am I good at what I'm doing? Like, should I? Is this even what I should be doing now at a time in my life where I'm definitely supposed to have a career? And I feel like I'm two tangents away from our main track of conversation, but that's totally fine with me. And I don't even remember the point I was trying to make, but I get what you're saying.
No, I loved your point. I loved your point because I think it's exactly true. Like my first 2 years, so maybe I took a little bit longer to the learning curve, but my first 2 years really was, how do I play the game to please the people I'm working for? Mm-hmm. So yes, I love the kids, but I was still much more, a little bit more no nonsense, a little bit more. Year two, I did get looser with my relationships with the kids because I was like, okay, first year, I was stark. I was like, okay, we hug on side and, you know, try not to not follow the rules, but that was really counterintuitive. So I ended up hugging them. And so by year two, I was a little bit more comfortable, but then also because it wasn't my first year and I wasn't a brand new teacher, like they saw me as baby teacher, like literally my group of English language arts, other teachers called me baby teacher. Mm-hmm. That was what they called me. Right. So I was proving myself in these different things, right. To my principal, to my coworkers, to the kids, to the parents, all in different ways. And so by year 3, 4, 5, I did feel a lot more empowered to do things like, okay, it's a snow day. Fuck it. We're going to the snow. It's Texas. Like this doesn't happen. I don't care if the other teachers think I'm lame.
Right.
And just trying to bring more things. Like I tried to make it so we could have a field trip through English language arts, which all the field trips are like more for the electives. And so just trying to push the envelope there. We did a night field trip. We went to a spoken word poetry event where I took a bunch of middle school kids too, and it was late at night at like 10 p.m. and it was super cool, and there was like a jazz band, and we created a bunch of different clubs. One year we had a club for The Office, like so the TV show, like a fan club of me and a bunch of the kids that loved The Office, and we called it the Party Planning Committee. Okay, so if you don't get it, you didn't watch The Office. But the point being, like I did get a lot more open with what I was doing with the kids outside of, you know, the classroom. And in the classroom. And in the classroom, I think this was the movement of differentiated instruction. So when I moved into, by the time I got into public education, it was all about facilitation, not, you know, teacher-led instruction, student-led instruction. And, you know, again, a differentiated classroom where you've got like, this group is reading this poem that's somewhat easy, and this one's reading a little bit harder one, and this group is reading a little bit harder one. And then you're going around and you're supporting these differentiated, you know, groups of kids. Which is again, like asking for a Jesus teacher. Like that's not a real thing you can do. That's like, I need three of me at least to do that well. And then also, of course, kids had narratives about that, right? They can tell if they're not reading the easiest poem, right? So there's all of that. So it's like, is it differentiated or is it like kind of creating this separation of perceived intelligence based on what their grade is in the class?
Right.
And then it was like, okay, they were trying to get me to make seating charts. So I put the low kid next to the high kid on a score they got on a benchmark to see if they could fix each other, or like the high one could bring the low one up. And it's like, no, I'm going to sit them next to people that they work well with. I'm not going to sit them next to people just because their score is low and their score is high. Like that's it's so anyway, there was just all of these things that I just started letting go of. And then with differentiated instruction, I tried to do it the best that I could. And I brought in, like, you know, outside things. Like, I tried to bring in, like, the Truman Show and things from, like, Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson. And gosh, there's so many people that I tried to pull in from that would just allow for it to be a more creative space. Oh, I talked about, like, Charlie Hebdo when all of that happened. So trying to pull things from, like, the art world too, because all these kids were, like, budding artists. So trying to pull in, you know, hey, can you, again, kind of almost like shock value. Hey, like, look at this crazy thing that happened. What do you think? So yeah, so I totally see that transition, but it was slow for me. And I think it wasn't until like year five. So at the end of year four was when I met Blake.
Yeah.
So just kind of going back to that. So I met Blake because year four, at the beginning of year four, I was like, okay, I've really thought that I could do this. This is not really for me. And I think, again, it was a bunch of seeds being planted, right? So it was all of the things that I said about, like, you know, from when I was in Montessori to when I was in public school and my principal was saying, think outside of the box, but also be inside the box. And showing us all these awesome, you know, videos about people talking about how school sucks, but then not having the space to do anything about it. And then also having I had a lot of autonomy in my classroom just because they didn't have time to come check on me and my scores were good. So by the time I was in, you know, year five, I was really trying a bunch of stuff and just trying low, not get in trouble, but knew I was leaving. Like I knew through all year five that I was leaving. Like I knew I was leaving. So it was just the year of saving money and having my exit plan. But at the end of year four, I met Blake because I got involved in the budding idea of having a conference around self-directed education in Texas. So there was one self-directed community in Texas, in Dallas, at that time that I was like, oh gosh, I need to do something different. So in year four, I was like, let me just Google alternatives to traditional education, right? And one of the things that came up after I'm like scrolling, okay, not Montessori, okay, is Arrow, right? The Arrow website.
Yeah.
And that has, you know, all the list of all of the schools and all of the states and all of the places, right? They're not always super up to date, but they are there. And Makarios was the only school in my area. And I didn't even know it existed, but it's called Makarios. And I actually called Makarios on a day that I had off, like just impulsively. And a kid answers the phone and says, hi, Makarios, you know, learning community. This is Oliver. How can I help you? And I'm like, oh my God. What's happening? And then I like set the tour date. I mean, the tour time, and I came up and then the kid gave me the tour. And then like, even, I didn't even know how young the kid was until I saw them in person and they were like 9. And I was like, I thought you were like 17 at least if you were going to be. And it was, they were so great at the tour, so articulate. And anyway, I ended up connecting with the owner of Makarios to create a conference around self-directed education. Yeah. And so that's how I met Blake, because I brought him down for the podcast. I mean, not for the podcast, for the, as the keynote speaker. And then I got to pick his brain about what I should do.
Real quick, I definitely want you to go on, but it just reminded me of this experience that I had in 2017. I traveled around the whole country, like meeting listeners and visiting schools and home educators and unschoolers. And one of the early stops was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania at the Circle School.
Oh, love them at the Circle School.
Me and my friend Tony went up there to do like a group meeting one day. We walk in, and I knew very little about what to expect. I walk in, a teenager who is not even like, you know, you're the one who answers the phones. He's just the kid who sees two adults walk in. And, you know, my experience working with kids in public school more often than not always, and I don't want to generalize, had been like, oh, great, here comes more adults. But this kid goes, oh, great. Here comes new adults. And he walks right up to me and Tony, and he's like, who are you guys? You probably have interesting stories. Other adults do. So it was like a totally different experience having done like in-home tutoring and teaching SAT classes like all these years prior, that was my previous experience with teenagers, which is like basically get away from me. I know what you're all about, adult, to like somebody taking what really seemed like a genuine interest. And then they had like this large classroom. I mean, most of the school is kind of like open and then they have some smaller rooms. They have like a music room and like a computer room. But whatever their largest classroom was, we packed like, it seemed like 50 people into this classroom for people to just Q&A me. And some of the people who ran the school were kind of mad at me because they had heard me be critical of Sudbury, and not like fully critical of Sudbury, but just express like, you know, fair hearing. Here's some things about Sudbury that I do like, and here's some things I don't like. So there were some tense moments.
Critical about every model that is coming up within self-directed, not critical as in like, wow, you're not being revolutionary. You're being revolutionary, but
yeah,
there are flaws in each one. And there are also, you know, kids that thrive maybe differently in each environment as well. And if we get too dogmatic in one, it'll be the same thing. If we say Montessori is the way, or Sudbury is the way, or agile learning is the way, then it's public school all over again, in my opinion, because there's not ever just one perfect way. And it looks different everywhere. And sometimes I've felt like Sudbury has been attempted to be reproduced, but not in even the true vein of like what I envision Sudbury to be. I think Hudson Valley is a great example of what I envision Sudbury to be. I don't know if you've been there, but
I haven't been there yet.
Take. I recommend it. Super recommend it.
I will do it. A guy that I used to work with named Thaddeus Russell. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. He was he's an author. He's a historian. He was getting involved with them somehow. And he was really, I'm pretty sure it was that. He was like really excited about what they, he's like, you of all people have to go look at this. So I will, now if it's been recommended twice, I will take a closer look at Hudson Valley. But you're leading up in your story to meeting Blake. And I think this is like a really, really important thing to get into, because I already know this part of your story. You have doubts about what could be next for you, and you feel motivated. You're having lots of questions about how things are working and what you're surrounded by. And I think this is really great, not just for educators who might be looking for something new, but all these parents that we talked about at the very beginning of the show, and all of these students who are, you know, like my niece, who's 12 or 13. And has all of these questions, very, very wise for her age, but doesn't see the options or the possibility, or for whatever reason, because of that lack of vision, it's hard to muster the courage to actually do something. So you said Blake was really a helpful person in your journey for that, for the advice that he gave you at this point, right?
Huge, huge. So I was like, hey, can I get coffee with you before you speak at the conference? Hey, let me steal more of your time while you're here. And so, you know, I just told him, like, I'm just not sure I want to be involved in public education anymore. And I feel like, but I feel like I have no other choice. I feel like this is what I went to school for. This is what I know how to do. I'm good at this. I know how to do this. I am, you know, respected in what I do. I worked really, this is my whole childhood, like, right? My whole freaking life. I'm like, I'm going to be a teacher, and I'm going to make a difference, and I'm going to help kids that were like me that weren't okay. And there were parts of that story that I told myself that were a little bit true. There were some kids that I was really showing up for and that really needed me, and that I perceived really needed me, right? And I was a different kind of teacher than a lot of the teachers at the school I was at before. So I was very different. I was much more maybe a safe space for those kids. So to even think about walking away from that. So a combination of like, what am I even fit to do outside of this? I'm really good at this. The kids really seem like they need me. I really kind of need them. I really care about them. I feel like I'd be abandoning them. I feel like I'd be abandoning the thing I wanted to do my entire life, besides the, you know, assurances of healthcare and financial stability. And, you know, I have my own apartment right in Dallas, which is expensive. And how would I do something different if that's going to be something I have to deal with, and all the other things to pay for, obviously. And then what makes me fit to do self-directed? So I knew I was learning about, you know, I was really on the ASDE website, and I was reading a bunch of books, right? I was reading tons of Danny Greenberg. I was reading John Holt, John Taylor Gatto. I was reading Joel Hammond. I was watching TED Talks, all of those different things to really like immerse myself in what is self-directed education. But at that time, I was still reading theoretically. So besides visiting Makarios, I was still reading all the theory, right? All of the romanticism of everything, but not necessarily how does it look in practice. And so I was also like, I don't really know what this is like either. And I don't really know who I would be in that environment. I just know where I am right now is not aligned with me. And this feels more like it could be, and more like what I wanted as a kid, and more like when I was in Montessori, I guess, was part of what I thought, or more when I had mentors in my life that were helpers, not judges. And so I really wanted to move into that space, but I was like, psh, if I call up somebody in self-directed, they're gonna be like, why would I want you? You're a broken public school teacher. Like, why would I want this person who thinks they know all the things and has spent all of, you know, this 5 years pushing her own agenda onto kids that were a forced audience? Why would I want that woman in my space? That's like the opposite of what we want in self-directed spaces. We don't want people like that. And now I'm going to have to, you know, she would have to unlearn, and she'd probably be terrible to kids all along the way and all of this. And so I was like, no, nobody's going to want me. And who am I to reach out to anybody? Blake just said, yeah, you know, I don't remember exactly the quote he said, but it changed my whole way of thinking. He's like, the difference isn't about being like qualified. It's like, either you're going to be the one that steps up and does it, or you're not. So it's not about like, oh, you're qualified to do self-directed education. It's like, no, you in your ownness, you know, in your heart, you need to step up into that environment. And because of that, you will become qualified.
How many people are wanting to step up and not going to, but you can?
They're not going to. They're not going to. And he even said, like, hey, I did Unschooled Adventures. Had I done that? Had I ever, like, done that myself before? No, I just made it a thing. I made it a thing. I went and traveled and I said, we're going to go here, 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 here. I put it on the internet. I made it a thing. I'd never worked with unschoolers before. Mm-hmm. He's like, you could do all sorts of different things. You could just do a summer camp in Texas one summer and do a little bit more self-directed type of summer camp and see what happens. Or you could do, like, we just were brainstorming all these things. I'm like, but I'm not you. I couldn't do that. And he's like, why not? And I'm like, So it was just all of these, like, breaking down those, you know, those frameworks that I had in my mind of, like, yeah, but I can't do that. Blake right. can do that, but I can't do that. You know, Joel Hammond can do that, but I can't do that. And just the pure thing of, like, again, I'm having to say I'm right. Everybody else in those systems that I was a part of that I really invested in are wrong. Again, about my own education, about my own, you know, teaching journey, that they were wrong and I really was right. And my internal compass is okay and valid and right. And then I can use that heart, you know, drive to push me forward into learning what I need to learn. And so once I was there and Blake and the Art of Self-Directed Learning, that book was super influential to me. I think any teacher or person that's wanting to move from a traditional mindset to a self-directed mindset needs to read that book for themselves. It's really all about how do you become a self-directed learner. And a lot of us as adults have been disempowered by the school systems that we forget that, or by our workplace systems. And at the same time, if we really think about it, we're all self-directing in certain ways, right? If I need to change my oil and I don't have time to go somewhere, I YouTube video it and I try to figure it out, right? That's self-directed. Yeah. So I was acquainting myself with that part of myself, and the Art of Self-Directed Learning really, like, has a great chapter that talks all about writing a love note to a mentor, basically, like finding, you know, somebody that you really, you know, revere. Like, maybe it was, you know, John Taylor Gatto for me. Maybe it was Danny Greenberg. Ken Danford for me was actually who, one of the main people that I wanted to connect with really early on. And same with Joel Hammond, just because, again, his book is literally like the Teacher Liberation Handbook is like he was in teaching for 5 years. Then he left. Then he created this thing. And so just writing an email to them and saying, like, wow, you are incredible. Here are all of the amazing things that I've noticed that you've done that I really value. You know, even saying, like, maybe I could offer something, you know, in return for all that you've done, would there be a time that we could meet or talk? And, you know, you actually have to propose a time. You can't just leave it open-ended. There's certain ways to do it, but that you can really reach out to people and that they're not going to be, like, offended if you do it in a way that's really like, wow, I really revere your work. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to, you know, I'm just going to put a feeler out there and see if you'd be willing to share your passions with me. And so that was huge, because that's what really started me being able to kind of plan that year after that fifth year. So that fifth year was spent, a lot of it, saving money. I moved into my parents' house to save rent so that I could do this thing next year. And then, you know, saying goodbye to the kids, making peace with all of that. And then year six was that, like, I call it like a sabbatical year, where I went to different spaces. So I was looking for internship opportunities on the ASD forums. I was looking at on the Arrow forums. This is where people post if you are looking for opportunities like internships or apprenticeships at places. Look at the Arrow website, look on the ASD website, reach out to people that you know in self-directed spaces and see if they know anyone. So that's basically what happened. I applied for an internship at Houston Sudbury School. So it was about 3.5 hours away from where I lived, and they were able to provide housing for me. And I asked for a $200 stipend for food per month. And it was amazing. I lived in the third floor of the school. For about 4 months. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. So that was kind of like, I guess, my first step into kind of that sabbatical year.
You did North Star too, right?
Yes. Yeah. So that was my hope was, this is something that's interesting too, is I really wanted to see a bunch of different spaces. So I felt it was really important for me to not just see a Sudbury school, or not just see a North Star, a Liberated Learners school, or not just see, you know, these specific models, but really see them all, you know, as many as I can separately for a good amount of time, if possible, to really see how it plays in the long game. Self-directed is the long game. I mean, it's interesting to say, but it is, it's such the long game. Like, you might have a kid that doesn't want to read when they're four, and then you're around, they're not reading. And suddenly at nine, they've read like 5 Harry Potter books, and you just figured out that they had, and so seeing that is huge, seeing that development over time. So it was really helpful to be in spaces for at least a couple months at a time. And so I was at North Star in the spring. And the same idea, one of the board members was able to house me, and they were able to provide me a very small stipend to stay up there. And I was apprenticing with Ken, and that was really great. And then in between all of those, I was visiting other spaces either for, you know, a couple of days, or I was, there was two local places here, Makarios, and a new one had popped up by that time, called Inspired Learning Academy. So when I wasn't at Houston or, in Massachusetts, I was at these two centers locally and or visiting other places like Hudson Valley. I visit Hudson Valley. I visited Brooklyn Apple Academy. I visited, you know, NYC Agile. Let me see, Macomber. I mean, I could keep going. So I try to visit a lot of different centers as well and like meet new people, build my network. I think a huge thing is building your network and doing that in a loving way. Obviously, you're not doing it for yourself selfishly. You're doing it to, you know, really help expand the amount of people that you're in contact with in order to, I don't know, in order to learn more from their wisdom.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've actually seen some long-term studies on this now too. I mean, like going to like different schools that have different ages and talking to people who've been in this for different lengths of time and also talking to staff. That was one of the really cool things about the Circle School and a couple of the other places and people that I visited with on my trip. But yeah, Peter Grace talked about this on Freedom to Learn, right? Just looking at like the long-term studies of outcomes for these people. And it all looked really encouraging. I mean, when I started doing my show, I knew these were the answers, right? Like I had read Gatto, I had seen A Different Kind of Teacher, and really just that, like, what does it take to create an environment where kids can find meaning? So, I was very much a true believer in all this, but I think I got to like episode 20 of my show and I said, wait a minute, what if I'm full of shit? Right? What if this doesn't work? You know, what if this is just some kind of idealism and needing to go? And so then it became part of my project for, I mean, it's been a decade of trying to, as consistently, as regularly as possible, talk to people like yourself who've experienced success in these environments, who've seen it from lots of different angles. I mean, I was schooled thoroughly, 15,000 hours in public school. So yeah, that all sounds great to me, but I didn't get to live that. But I've gotten to meet, like, I've had great guests who were homeschooled or unschooled or, you know, took themselves out of school, and people who've worked in these kinds of environments at all different levels. So I feel like we built a comprehensive picture that is experiential at this point. But, you know, I remember 2010, and I got to episode 20 of my podcast, and I went, hope I'm right. You know, I hope I'm right. Yeah. And there were a lot less resources and a lot less connection at that point to, I mean, I knew those voices were important and I had to find them, but it's always just, it's really satisfying and really meaningful whenever I can have somebody, you know, who's had this experience, who's seen all of these different things. I mean, I traveled, I got to see some of it, but those were very, you know, in and out kinds of things. And they were great and made some good connections and got some great guests out of it. But no, I really appreciate that story. And it's all been leading up to you actually founding your own Liberated Learners Model Center called EPIC. And I want to give you I think you're going to need to come back at some point, if you will, and talk all about the agile learning piece of this, because I think we could do like a whole hour on that. And it's definitely something that I'd like to learn more about and have my audience learn more about. But I know it's a feature of what you do at EPIC. So as we're kind of in the home stretch here, can you talk about taking this experience that you've shared with us so far, applying it to EPIC, what EPIC is? EPIC is an acronym, by the way. So what that is, what the principles and practices are there. And then we'll cliffhang it. And hopefully in the near future, we can talk more about Agile.
That sounds perfect. Yeah. So I guess after North Star, one of my friends that I mentioned earlier, Kristen Montesano, gave me a phone call and said, hey, Makarios, the school I mentioned earlier, is moving like an hour away from their current campus. And so a lot of families aren't going to be able to make that, you know, drive or be able to get to that new location. And Kristen was like, I know this mom at Makarios that was really interested in maybe opening something up where kind of near where Makarios was. You want to be on the team? And I'm like, oh yeah. So it was literally while I'm on the train back to, you know, on the train to get on the plane to come back to Texas from being at North Star. So it was literally like very, you know, timely, how that happened. And then I came back and we just started working on, you know, literally it was end of March, started working on creating EPIC to open September. So super fast turnaround. And with, you know, Kristen, I worked with, you know, a little bit on the conferences that I mentioned earlier, but I'd never worked with Kelsey before. And I had just come from this whole, you know, sabbatical time. And so it was really cool to kind of all work together to create, you know, the vision that we had for this new learning community and who we would want to serve and what that could look like and where would we have it. And so there was so much that went into that. You know, we looked at houses, we looked at commercial spaces, we looked at, you know what I mean? All of that kind of stuff, finding where to be. Finding some families that would be, you know, interested in starting. So we did have some families from Makarios that we were able to move over to EPIC as a good starting base of kids that a starting base of kids that already kind of knew about self-directed from Macarios and had relationships with me and Kristen, because I was, again, on and off interning at Macarios, right. And then Kristen was working at Macarios. So we started Epic September of 2019 with a mix of liberated learners as the base framework and then agile tools as the culture creation, community creation piece. So to me, the liberated learners model is really four tenets. If you go on the Liberated Learners website, there are four things that make you a Liberated Learner Center that you have to be if you're going to be a Liberated Learner Center. And they're pretty simple. Out of school, you don't make kids have an attendance requirement. There's no requirement to come or not come. They choose. All of the offerings are chosen. And then the family is the ones in charge of the learner's education. So it's the family. They are all homeschoolers. And it's a family that takes it. So that's huge for me, because a lot of self-directed communities are calling themselves schools. Sudbury says we're a Sudbury school. Sometimes there's even agile schools, yeah. Or other self-directed spaces that say, you know, blank free school, right? A free school or some other name that still has the word school in it. And to me, that super implies that we're taking the ownership back again from the family to a different kind of school, but it's still the school's job to educate mm-hmm. their kid. And to me, I just want to break down that whole paradigm. Learning happens everywhere all the time. All the time, right? It's happening everywhere. So for us to call ourselves a school and say, we're going to take, you know, this time that they're here, they're going to learn, is to me not actually based in the movement that I believe in self-directed education. So I love that it's when we're taking on new learners, especially if they're coming from public school, I really explain to the parent, like, you are choosing to homeschool and Epic is a resource. So you are going to graduate your kid. You are going to help. And there's tons of things your kid can do when they're not at Epic that you could help support them in if you wanted to. But also if they're reading, that's huge. That's a huge part of learning. If they're just at home reading. But also if you own a chiropractor office and you want them to work at the front desk once a week and they're really interested in doing that. You know what I mean? There's learning that's happening all the time everywhere. So it doesn't have to be just at Epic. And that's why I love that model. Sorry. That's why I love the Liberated Learners model.
To that kind of blend of practices and philosophies that you're talking about there, from what I gathered, it's kind of, it's been one of your assets. I've heard you talk about the which one problem, where a lot of people, especially parents, experience a kind of paralysis around, well, there could only, for so long, we believe that this is the only way that education can work is with this very limited word. I totally agree with what you're saying. And that was great advice that I got from somebody named Laurette Lynn. She used to have a blog called The Unplugged Mom. You know Laurette? Oh, no? Okay.
Mm-mm, but I want to know.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know.
It should still be there. Unplug Mom. That was her brand. You could definitely search School Sucks Project and find a bunch of stuff with Laurette. But she said, let school do school. Now, I still would say that words like homeschooling and unschooling are important, like bridges to extend to people who might be looking for those things and looking for options. And that's the only vocabulary they have. But then once they cross the bridge into your world, say, guess what? We're not using the word school anymore. It's misleading. School does school. We don't do school. We do self-directed learning. So yeah, I'm totally, totally on board with that. But because of what has been built into people's minds about education through the limited possibilities of school that school provided, it's like, why did both of us become teachers? It probably seemed like the only track we could travel that would satisfy those professional needs that we had. And it was probably, you know, me being in that position 10 years or so before you, there were even fewer options. You know, my teaching career started in 2002. There was no awareness of options versus, like, you know, 2012. So mm-hmm. the which one problem.
Unless you knew someone who was in it, like unless you knew someone who was directly in one or you lived right near one.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I didn't have that benefit. So that which one problem is, it's like coming out of the schooled model. Parents are going to balk at this whole realm of possibilities, right? This whole spectrum of possibilities. I mean, well, which one would be absolutely perfect for my child? So to take this experience that you had, Sudbury, North Star, all of the theory that you had been involved with, other people that you're collaborating with at Epic, I think that really like works to your benefit as far as being able to outreach to people and maybe reassure people. It's not one way or you fail kind of proposition here.
Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately an eclectic mix of what aligned with me, the community that I knew I was going to be serving and the other people that were going to be creating the community with me is really what led me to want to really be like a liberated learners model with agile tools. I don't think that I was sure at all what model I liked personally, but I went from what model do I like or do I feel like I want to be a part of to also like every community is different, right? So if I was creating a school in New York City, it might need to look very different, or learning community, excuse me. See, I'm even doing it. And if I was going to create a learning community in New York City, it might look very different than to create one in Dallas or to create one in like rural California or somewhere, you know, like these are very different types of people, families, communities. So I think it's also important to, when you're creating your a learning community, really considering who you're going to be serving. And then if who you're serving needs something different, being willing to change. That's what I love about Agile. It's the whole idea of we're going to change and it's okay. And it doesn't have to be static and it doesn't have to be this. These are the rules and these are the things and this is how Epic works. It can change. And we've changed how things at Epic worked constantly since we've started. It's building the plane in the sky. So to pretend like we're not building this plane in the sky and that we've got this finished model perfectly polished is an illusion.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
We're all new here.
Yeah. And you've got like a pretty wide age range, right? It's like 4 to 18.
Yeah. So that's another reason why I felt, you know, Liberated Learners, most of the centers are about 11 and up. Mm-hmm. So I did feel like Agile, when I visited some of the Agile communities, that they also had a lot of other tools that served some of the younger kids that also could serve the older kids. But that the older kids, I think, prefer like scheduled classes for, you know, a certain amount of weeks in a row. That's what I've noticed is they kind of do like, okay, I committed to a class. I know when it's happening. Whereas some of the younger kids like a one-time offering, which is a little bit more kind of how Agile can be. It can be a lot more like, here's the week. Let's put sticky notes where we're adding new things. Here are the consistent things that are happening. So that's kind of cool instead of just having formal scheduled classes.
Absolutely. Can you tell me a little bit about how you like created these phases or where that idea came from? Like you have, you know, the early years, you foundation. And I think like people who listen to this show and anyone who's read like The Lost Tools of Learning by Dorothy Sayers will have some idea of this, but I just want you to talk about like how this framework was set up. So you have the early years, which is like foundational, the middle years, which is like the exploration phase, and then the older years, which is like direction, and maybe just provide a little bit of how the differentiation of each was created and why, considering that you're serving such a wide age range, you know, this model was sort of created and how it was created. I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. And so one of the things I noticed, and I think a couple of us that were creating Epic noticed, was that if you're in a self-directed space and you start at age 4 and it's just, you're just self-directed from 4 to 18 and there's not like, I guess a clear development of how that could look over time. Yeah. As a parent, that can be hard to commit to.
That's
as
it.
A kid, that can be hard to envision. Mm-hmm. Right. So to me, it's like, okay, is what my kid's going to do when they're 4 be the same experience they have when they're 17? And shouldn't it be different as they develop? And I agree. So, foundation mentoring and, you know, one-on-one time looks very different than exploration, mentoring, and one-on-one time, then direction. And then also kind of like you're saying, like the phases they're moving through. So if we have a kid that starts at age 4 and moves through our whole learning community until they're 18, they will have the support that they need based on, you know, their natural brain development. And we're not picking what group they're in, by the way. So foundation, exploration, direction, they have soft age things we say sometimes, but we really mean it could be any age. Right. So we have, and the kids and the parents pick, and we talk about like, this is what it looks like to be in foundation, exploration, direction, and the kids get to decide where they fall. So in exploration, we've had a 14-year-old. In direction, we've had a 10-year-old. In you know, foundation, we've had an 8-year-old. In exploration, we've had a 5-year-old. So it's not necessarily age chunked, but it's really like, where are you and what do you need at your stage of development perceived by your parents, you, and then us, if you want our input.
Yeah. The reason why I wanted to ask that is because like when I first went to your website and I saw that, I said, oh, that's so perfect for the new person. That's so perfect for the new person to see some semblance of structure with like a self-directed, or if they've heard the word unschooling. That's actually one of the things that's bothered me about some of my interactions with unschooling, where, okay, that unstructured thing is great, but how do you pass that on to somebody who's more skeptical of this? So something that was really helpful, this Dorothy Sayers, Lost Tools of Learning. I don't know if you're from, it's pretty obscure kind of a thing.
Mm-mm.
Dorothy Sayers was like, I think she was like she was British. She was a mystery novel writer, but she wrote this essay called The Lost Tools of Learning based on the trivium method of education, the classical education. And she said that kids mm-hmm. will progress through like a grammar stage of, you know, identification, naming things in their environment. And it's kind of like the phenomenon where you learn what a word means and then you start hearing it all the time. In a young learner's mind, like what goes unnoticed in their environment because it hasn't been made explicit, it hasn't been basically called into a definitional existence. And once, you know, that capacity
develops and a confidence develops around that capacity, then they move on to the second part of the trivium or the logic stage, right? So now that we have the building blocks of knowledge, how do we work with them? How do we integrate things? How do we remove contradictions by knowing what things are or having a better sense of what things are, a better knowledge of what things are? How do we develop understanding through that process? So that's like getting to that, what you call the exploration stage. Then the direction stage, as far as like actually what's implied in that for me is like taking action. Third part of the trivium, which is the rhetoric. So it goes grammar, logic, rhetoric. And the whole trivium thing is kind of a controversial topic for numerous reasons. But if you just kind of follow, like, here's a model that makes the learning process explicit, regardless of what all of the implications or the history or the uses of this thing are, then as kids gain confidence and that self-assurance to present, to advocate, to self-assert, they get to this rhetoric stage where it's like, here are the things I know. Here's how they work together. Here's how I'm going to tell you about them, right? And that could be, through things like presentation or debate or actually, trying to teach other people, trying to create something as an outcome of this knowledge and understanding gained. So I looked at that and I said, first of all, this is great for somebody who's encountering self-directed learning for the first time. That's like, oh, well, I get that. That's a pretty good flow of how things could work. But I immediately thought of this Dorothy Sayers Lost Tools of Learning thing when I saw it too. So I thought that was great. What is EPIC's website, by the way?
Yeah, it's epiclifelearningcommunity.com. So it's long, but it's all lowercase. That's a really great place to go to learn more about EPIC. I have my personal website, which is just CassidyYoungHands.com. Mm-hmm. And that has a lot of, the other things that I've written, other podcasts I've been on. And then I'm working on a new project, which actually with Ken Danford, inspired from Blake Bowles. He's in, kind of behind the scenes, but Blake is a little involved. And then Laura Smothers and Sunjata. And those are, kind of this team that we've created because we feel like you and me wanting to move into a self-directed or wanting to, move into a different space or questioning the education model now is happening more than ever for educators. Mm. So what we're creating is something called Another Way, which is going to be a program, a cohort where we're going to take hopefully 15 to 20 people that are interested through de-schooling, the history and science of self-directed education, and then to the what kind of models exist, what internships do you want to take on? Basically walking them through kind of what I did, but with support of people who have also done it and in their own way, right? In their own city, in their own framework of what they're hoping for. But that's something I'm really excited about because I've felt so long that that's something that I needed when I was in that, but I was lucky enough to find people, organically, but it's way easier if you have that support. And then also people to just chew all of that stuff that's so confusing at first, chew it with and talk together about it and say, oh yeah, you visited that space. Well, I'm really like, my mind's getting blown over here by this Sudbury kid because they're doing XYZ. And oh, you're over there in that, agile environment. And oh, Cassidy, you've been in both of those places. And so we can all talk and learn from each other. And it's a little bit of a way to legitimize what I did and what a bunch of other people like us have done. And also, again, allow there to be a little bit of a community through that. So that's starting hopefully at the end of February. There will be an application process. And so, of course, I'll share that with you. But the website is learninganotherway.com.
Awesome.
And on Instagram, it's learninganotherway. So that's just another project that I'm starting to work on that I'm super excited about.
That's terrific. So Instagram would be a good way for people to maybe stay in the loop about what's happening?
Yeah. And then also EPIC's Instagram is Epic Life Learning. So,
excellent.
So we're all over the gram,
Me too. Even though... I'm about to delete my Facebook, but that's another story. I can't give up Instagram yet.
Hey, you got to have that point. You got to make that point. There's got to be a day. We're all moving that direction, I hope so.
Indeed. Can I ask you to give one piece of advice before we end for today?
Yes.
Given this situation that a lot of people, like my audience is a lot of parents, a lot of people who are very, very supportive of the ideas we've discussed today. It is a great time for outreach, as people have more and more questions, more and more frustrations about what schooling equals education has meant to them, to their children. It is, like I said, a tremendous age of opportunity for connecting with new people on these ideas that we've both been promoting for a while. And I know it's a very individuated process too, but you have probably had opportunities and thought a lot about outreach to the people who now have these questions, even if they don't know the answers that they're looking for. Are there any tips that you would provide people who are like passionate about, because this is such an important thing to the entire future, the survival of our society, right, is that more people are independent-minded and self-sufficient. Like, it is getting very, very dangerous out there for people who do not have these things, I think. And I'm not trying to be an alarmist, but I'm very, very passionate about this, more so than I've ever been, which I think is a good thing at this point because I've been at it a long time. But what advice would you give for the people who are like trying, they know they've got that brother, they've got that sister, they're frustrated with what's going on with schooling right now, as far as like making a connection or just giving them something that is like chewable and digestible as a place to start warming up to these ideas that we're promoting?
Okay, so I have a couple different things. One, just when it comes to your internal mindset and the way that you show up when you're exploring these things, I think, especially if you're like you and I, and you're really kind of trying to move into self-directed, maybe also as a facilitator, mm-hmm. You can also be a parent, of course, you could also have a nephew, all of these things can be true, but trusting yourself, right? So my gut, right? Your gut, both of us, it was telling us like, this isn't the way we want to be with kids. This isn't the way, you know, and if you're a parent, this isn't, my kid's not thriving. I can feel it, right? This isn't what I want, the relationship I want to have with my kid, or, you know, my nephew, I'm really concerned about him. You know, I really want to talk to my sister about what could be possible right. for him. And a lot of that goes back to trusting yourself and knowing, yeah, I feel like something could be better or different. And I'm going to verbalize that. I'm going to move into that and hold true that like I'm trusting myself that, yeah, there's something about that that's real and right. And pursue worthy of pursuing. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing would be that I really learned is just, and this is, I learned it. And also it came naturally to me. So it might not come naturally to everybody else. So I do want to say it is talk about what you're passionate about all the time.
Yes.
Talk about it all the time. Talk about it all the time, because you're going to attract it. If you put it out there, it's going to come back so much more than you even think. Everybody that I've ever talked to about self-directed, I never think I'm going to hear from them again. And as you probably have experienced through this podcast and maybe even other avenues of your work in self-directed, it comes back full circle so often.
Oh, that, yes.
You know, 3 years down the line, they're calling you, oh my gosh, blah, blah, you know, and, or, oh, can I donate to your mission that I learned about, you know, 10 years ago when I thought you were a crackpot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so you got to keep putting it out there, even if it makes other people confused, or, and being confident, again, saying, I trust myself and this is what I believe in. And this is what I'm passionate about. And I'm not going to stop sharing it.
That is so awesome. And it's been so true. You know, like I've done this long enough that like my entire social circle now is like people that, because it can only be so big. It can only include so many people like who get, you know, individual attention and give me individual attention. It's entirely made up of people that I met through doing this work. You know, aside from
right.
a few old friends and family, of course. But even like family mm-hmm. is getting in on this at this point, which is great because I just won't give up. I just keep persisting and I just keep talking about the things that I'm passionate about. And I've gotten, you know, through numerous failures, communication wise, I've gotten better, where there was a time in the past where if like a conversation was going on about nephew's education and I walked into the room, everyone would go, shh, shh, shh. Like, stop. Here comes Brett.
Yeah,
here comes
yeah.
Brett to give a lecture. But, you know, just as more time's gone on, that has changed. And that's, I attribute that to, you know, being wiser about how to communicate with people about these things. And that's really important.
Can I jump in on
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because just real quick, exactly. Like, that's one of the things I learned is when I'm talking about it, bashing public school is not necessarily the best way to talk about it. And I had to learn that the hard way. I used to just like shit on public school. Just like when I would talk to people about this movement, and instead of talking about what I'm moving towards, I was talking about what I was running away from. And I think focusing on what we're moving towards is where we're going to really get people and momentum. People don't want to sit in the, oh, I'm not, this was terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to honor that it was, but then we need to move into what's the possible solutions? What are the next steps to do something different? And I used to just harp on like, you know, you don't remember anything you learned in science and your teacher, you were just coerced to sit there. You were a forced audience. You were a prisoner. Like, I know, and I don't not believe those things. And, you know, I realized that when I'm talking to wider audiences, that's not going to be the framework that they're necessarily going to vibe with initially, mm-hmm. especially if they're from a product of public school, like we talked about earlier, or if their kids go to public school, or if one kid goes to a self-directed space and one kid goes to a public school, which I've met lots of families where that's true. So that's just something I've learned as well. And then the last thing I'd say is just go to the ASD website, go to self-directed.org and teach yourself about the 6, you know, optimizing conditions of self-directed education. Look at the research, look at Peter Gray's research. You know, that's a good place to start, I think, because when we're struggling to trust ourselves, we see that, and it is evidence, and it is a legitimate nonprofit organization that has, you know, been around for now at least 5 years, because it was around when I was looking for, you know, to learn about self-directed education. It was open for like a month at that point. I think the website was up. So it has a lot of great short YouTube videos with beautiful illustrations that can really help just you get the toe in the water of what self-directed is. And then just like sit with that for a while and maybe start picking up one or two other books, but don't overwhelm yourself at first. You know, it's, again, it's the long game. You know, de-schooling is a process. Yeah. I'm still, you heard me a little bit ago say Epic was a school. Mm-hmm. And even a little bit ago, I think I told one of my friends like, oh, that kid that we have, he's going to be such a great like engineer one day. And it's mm-hmm. like, oh my gosh, I'm already like aligning him with some kind of profession where he's going to make money. Like, it's not, you know, so there's just these frameworks that we always have to undo. It's not, there's not a time where it ends.
Absolutely. Really well said. I'm still doing it too. So, and yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you please one more time, let my audience know every place that, well, I mean, web-wise, where they can find you, your personal website, Epic's website, and any other social media that you'd want to promote to thousands of people.
Yeah. So my name is Cassidy Younghands. So it's CassidyYounghands.com. It's H-A-N-S because there's no D. So it is hands, but there's no D. And then EpicLifeLearningCommunity.com. And then for that project that I was talking to you about called Another Way, it's LearningAnotherWay.com.
Excellent. This has been a wonderful conversation for me. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And I look forward to doing this again soon.
Thank you too. Bye, Brett. This has been so wonderful.
Everybody is a star who ran and chased the dust away.
Everybody wants to shine. We'll come out on a cloud day.
'Tis the sun that loves you round when the system tries to bring you.
Ain't no stopping until it's in the ground.